Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm your host, Dave Marshall, and this is episode 108 on plesiosaurs, in which I speak to Dr. Benjamin Keir, the vertebrate curator at the Museum of Evolution, Paleontology and Mineralogy at Uppsala University. Now, an interview on plesiosaurs was originally requested by one of our listeners, June Chang, but here we cover so much more than just what a plesiosaur is. We go into fantastic details about what their remains can tell us about their world, and we even take a look at the Australian opal mining industry. There was so much that I learned from this episode, from how plesiosaurs lived, their ecology, to the fact that opal is actually made out of fossils. So if you too learn something new, please give us a like on social media. Likes, shares, comments, and reviews all really help the show get noticed and would be greatly appreciated. And as always, if you want to see what we've been talking about, images that accompany this episode can be found at paleocast.com. I hope you enjoy learning all about plesiosaurs. Hi, Ben. Thank you so much for coming on to the show.
No problem. It's an absolute pleasure.
Right. We always start our interviews with the usual question of asking how you became a paleontologist. So we want to know what happened from when you first picked up a fossil to where you are today.
I suppose it's the Peter Pan effect with me. I never wanted to do anything else. So for as long as I can remember, it's been dinosaurs and all the rest of it. But I suppose my quintessential moment, my epiphany occurred as a young kid growing up on the south coast of England. So I'm from Australia, but my parents carted me off to the UK to grow up for the first 5 years of my life. And so I sort of had a great experiences in places like Lyme Regis and this sort of thing. And of course, wandering along the beach, picking up fossils is a mind-blowing experience for a young kid, and it's never stopped. So strangely enough, from Lyme Regis, I still work on ancient marine reptiles. So this is my bread and butter, so to speak.
Okay, and so university and PhD, what was your PhD in?
My PhD was in fossil marine reptiles. So I, for the last, I'm afraid to say it, more than 20 years now, I've been working on fossil marine reptiles of one sort or another. So my PhD was actually working on opal fossils from places like Coober Pedy and Andamooka, which is in central Australia. These are opal mining towns. So you have to imagine a place that hits 52 degrees in the summer. It's so hot, people live underground. This is where 80% of the world's gem quality opal comes from. And what most people don't recognize is that when you buy, you know, the rings, the jewelry, the tacky keychains and all this sort of stuff, they're cut from fossils. So this is shells or belemnites, which is the remains of squid-like animals and bones, which are basically replaced by opal. And how this occurs is a bit of a mystery. But the general idea is you have a hydrated silica and some sort of silica-rich groundwater, and either you have bacteria or weathering, which is pushing, basically making the silica-rich groundwater dissolve the original fossil and replace it in opal, which is more or less like a natural glass, if you want to look at it that way. So the idea is you get these beautiful fossils, which are cut into gems. So it's the opal mining is how the fossils are found, but some of these fossils are just spectacular, and what they represent is an ancient freezing polar environment.
Wow. Like, I wonder, when you explain what your PhD is, how many people are just completely blown away, like, have no idea that this is the case? I mean, even me as a paleontologist, I had no idea that most opal came from fossils.
Yeah, most people don't. But the reality is a large part of it is cut from fossil material. I mean, most of it is shells and other things like this. And the bones, to be honest with you, are not so good because bones obviously are quite porous and the sediment and bits and pieces get inside them. So they're not great for cutting gemstones. Having said that, though, I have seen ichthyosaur skeletons worth $2,000, $2,500 a carat. So it's quite impressive stuff. But It's amazing material. But really, as a scientist, the opal's interesting. But the reality of what it represents in terms of ancient environments and ecosystems and the biology of these animals is even more interesting. Because you have to realize that Australia, in this case, about 120 million years ago, isn't where it is today. It was actually a polar landmass. So throughout the Mesozoic, Australia's been down at the South Pole. And it's only in the last sort of 40 million years that it started drifting north. But what it means is that all these ancient sea creatures are more or less the equivalent of like leopard seals and penguins that we get today. This is the kinds of animals that are living at the South Pole. And what's even more interesting is that the Mesozoic, the age of dinosaurs, wasn't all like the Bahamas. It's not swaying palm trees and nice warm climates. It's actually, I mean, you're talking about, you know, a massive amount of time. And during this time, there were climate change events and there were cold snaps. There's a point at which the Cretaceous, about 120 million years ago, where you have icebergs, you know, and you've got marine reptiles swimming around it. There's dinosaurs on the land. There's all sorts of weird and wonderful things going on. So you have to imagine that you've got plesiosaurs, and this is the, you know, fabulous Loch Ness monster kind of animals with big long necks swimming around with ice. And this is the world of Central Australia 120 million years ago.
You've basically just covered our entire interview. All of the questions, you pretty much answered them straight in that. So we'll consider that the abstract to this whole interview, and we'll visit each one of those points and unpack it all and discuss it all in more details. But still, I want to know more about you and your job. And okay. So you are now a vertebrate curator at the Museum of Evolution in Uppsala. Yes. Is that right?
Yep. So I'm a docent, which is like an associate professor in the Swedish system, and curator of vertebrate paleontology at the Museum of Evolution at Uppsala University. So the Museum of Evolution is the oldest paleontological and largest original collection of vertebrate material in Scandinavia. So it's got specimens going back to 1658. This is where Linnaeus's material is. So this is, you know, Linnaeus was the guy that invented taxonomy and how we name stuff. He worked on fossils, and the fossils he worked on are in the collection here. So what many people don't know is also that this is the, you know, the great adventure of Chinese fossils started from Uppsala. So the Sino-Swedish expeditions in the early 20th century, which went off to collect material, both sort of ethnographic stuff and fossils, brought it all back to Sweden and brought it all back to Uppsala University. So, you know, there's spectacular things like dinosaur material, the Helopus, which is a famous sauropod, and Peking Man. The famous Peking Man lives in Uppsala. We have him here. So, or her. So the idea is that, you know, this one of these classic old collections from the days of when material from all over the world was funneled back to Europe. But it's a mind-boggling resource to have at your fingertips. But what brought me to Uppsala? I mean, I'm an Aussie refugee in the north. So basically, I work on polar environments from the age of dinosaurs. And when you work on polar environments in the age of dinosaurs, one of the best places to go is the Scandinavian Arctic. So I spend my summers working in Greenland and Svalbard and places like that. So the idea is that the first expeditions to go out and hunt for vertebrate fossils and other fossils from the age of dinosaurs were launched from what is now the Museum of Evolution, Uppsala University. So this is really the kind of epicenter for a lot of this stuff. And that's kind of what, with a large degree of chance, brought me here. So my work is more or less focused on trying to unravel how the polar environments have driven and affected global distribution of marine vertebrates, particularly marine reptiles. Because as it seems, changes at the poles have been very, very important for the primary transition of a land-living animal back to the sea. So this is no less significant than the evolution of birds. It's just looking at how an animal adapting its walking limb and changing it into a flipper, how this has worked and why this has worked. And strangely enough, these sort of events coincide with major what we call biotic perturbations, changes in life, major extinction events and recovery events. And my primary interest is looking at how climate and things like sea level might have affected this and how it's all worked. So in Greenland and Svalbard, I'm looking at the Permo-Triassic extinction, recovery from the largest extinction event of all time. 80% of life on Earth snuffs it overnight. And on the back of that, we had the radiation of the first reptiles, in this case, and amphibians returning to life in the sea. Why does it happen? What goes on? And there's all sorts of biodiversity change that goes hand in hand. And don't forget, the beginning of the Triassic was one of the most extreme global warming events in Earth history. So it has very important parallels for what we see in biodiversity and ecological change today. And that's kind of where I'm trying to drive my research at the moment. Australia, on the other hand, is the same thing, but in the South Pole. So short of going to Antarctica, which doesn't, although it does have late Cretaceous marine reptiles, doesn't have earlier material yet, Australia is the next best thing. So what I'm doing in Australia at the moment, and have been doing for a long time, is looking at, again, at these big climate change events. So the beginning of the age of dinosaurs is marked by global warming. The middle of the Cretaceous, the last part of the age of dinosaurs, is marked by a global temperature drop and then a massive global warming event. And this is very, very important for the radiation of all sorts of marine reptiles, but most of all, plesiosaurs. Plesiosaurs go through some major radiation and biodiversity turnover in conjunction with these sort of climate and sea level fluctuation events. And that's really the big driver. Well, how can we use the fossil record to understand these big changes and what drives major biodiversity change through time? And how can we relate this back to today?
That's really interesting that you are looking at the fauna and then trying to understand the climate through that. All of my questions I've written down are, how can we understand what's happening to the fauna based on what's going on in the climate? I never thought about it the opposite way around. So that's really interesting.
Well, crucially, it's the fossils that give us all the information, because it's the ecosystems. Yes, we have the sedimentary record, but the ecosystems are what tell us about the responses to this climate change. How can we map climate change using the fossil record, which is organisms? And we can use all sorts of approaches, but ranging from isotopic geochemistry coupled with phylogenetic modeling, ecosystem modeling, you name it, we can throw everything at it. And this is kind of what I'm interested in doing now, is looking at this multifaceted approaches of how we can meld data to understand what's going on, and using these really great points in the global fossil record, which give us a very crucial window into some of the most large-scale events that have affected marine ecosystems on the planet over the last 100, 200 million years.
Okay, so I'd first like to get right down to basics and understand and put in context what's happening in Australasia. So throughout the Mesozoic era, so the Triassic, Jurassic, Cretaceous, where is Australasia, and which paleocontinents was it stuck into? When did it separate and become its own thing?
Yeah. So what we now understand is Australasia being Australia, New Zealand, New Caledonia, Timor, this kind of stuff, is they're all fragments of Gondwana. So you'd have to imagine that if we take it back to the beginning, 251.9 million years ago, the birth of the Mesozoic, it's all a kind of peninsular region of eastern Gondwana that straddles the South Pole. You're right on the southern polar circle. So the idea is it pretty much stays there. It doesn't move around, and there's obviously some shifting, but more or less it's staying at this point throughout most of the Mesozoic. What we know of marine ecosystems from this time, which is very similar to the terrestrial ecosystems where you have dinosaurs and all this kind of stuff, and the early Triassic sort of amphibian radiations, it's quite unique. And this is an interesting point, because it comes up again and again and again. The idea is, even from way down at the beginning of the Triassic, the Australian fauna is quite unusual. It's got its own flavour, much like it does today. It's doing its own thing. So the idea that keeps coming up and has been brought up for many, many times since the 80s is we've got some kind of, because it's not geographically isolated, so theoretically you could walk from Sydney to Beijing, but the idea is you've got some sort of thermal barrier that's kind of stopping things getting across the pole. Even at the, you know, the globally peak temperatures, you're still going to have a temperature gradient of some sort going down to the poles. So the idea is you've got these kind of encapsulated ecosystems. So Australia's been out on its own for a very long time. And it's this kind of idea, you've got sort of relic assemblages, things that survive in Australasia much longer than elsewhere. But more importantly, what's coming to the fore now is actually it's a lot of components of the flora and fauna which seem to be ancestral. So the poles aren't necessarily where things go to hide out because they can't survive anywhere else. It's rather that you might have an evolutionary cradle going on, particularly where you have global climate change events. So, for example, if we take the early Triassic, it's peak temperatures. The Earth is cooking. It's supposed to be, by some estimates, so hot at the equator that it's lethal. That's probably a bit extreme, but it's certainly very warm. So you have to imagine the seas are much warmer than they are today. So the idea is that's been put forward is you have a degree of early ecosystems recover sooner at the poles than they do at the equator. So the idea has come up that you might have the poles as some kind of refuge. Things go and hang out there while the equator's cooking. And then as the climate stabilizes, they all start to come out again. And this is one of the key things that I'm interested in testing using the Scandinavian Arctic record. Do we actually see this? Is it real? And one of the key aspects of this is the idea that's been around for some time now is you've got about a 10 million year window in which, imagine, marine ecosystems are devastated. Reefs have been completely obliterated. There's no big marine predators. And then suddenly they start to come back again. The ecosystems rebound. But the idea is you're supposed to have this 5 to 10 million year gap where you have no big marine predators. Is this true? Do we actually see this in the fossil record? What's starting to become clear is no. It looks like reptiles got into the oceans very, very quickly after the Permo-Triassic extinction. And they just radiated crazy. They went mad. And radiated all these different fabulous and weird and wonderful ecosystem niches. And then they went, boom, global. So the idea is that you've actually got relatively stable sort of latitudinal gradients. And things can just, you know, you've got a supercontinent, Pangaea, and marine animals can migrate all around the coastline. And it looks like they did it. That's exactly what's happened. So it's not just reptiles as well. There's these early weird marine amphibians, thing called trematosaurids, which look a bit like a crocodile, but are more related to salamanders and frogs. But these seem to get into the oceans as well. So you imagine these bizarre, weird and wonderful early Triassic seas with these amphibian crocodile-like things and early ichthyosaurs and all this sort of stuff, these weird critters running around. The idea is trying to look at this in the Australian sector. What we can see is certainly we have these early amphibian-dominated sort of coastal marine environments. Some very, very bizarre creatures living in there. And over time, it's replaced by other types of reptiles, in this case, ichthyosaurs. Ichthyosaurs are the classic fish-like, as the name means, fish lizard. But in the Triassic, early Triassic, they don't quite look like that. They're a kind of a proto-ichthyosaur. The idea generally is that they get more and more adapted to marine environments. The other major group of marine reptiles are called sauropterygians, and this is the lineage that eventually gives rise to plesiosaurs, but that doesn't happen for quite some time. But the idea is the earliest sort of sauropterygians are getting around at this point in time too, but there's been no real record of them from anywhere other than the Northern Hemisphere. That is until relatively recently. So it turns out that there are some sauropterygian remains from New Zealand, which is new material, but I give you an advanced tip here. But the idea from this is that basically they too went global, and they went global, you know, fairly early on within that sort of 10 million year bracket after the Permo-Triassic extinction event. However, it wasn't until somewhat later that the actual plesiosaur lineage evolved. And plesiosaurs are what we want to talk about today. So the idea is that the first plesiosaurs evolved from some sort of sauropterygian-like ancestor. And they evolved fairly quickly into the classic long-necked type of thing. So everybody can envisage the Loch Ness Monster. Big long neck, four flippers, this kind of thing. And that's pretty much what a proto-plesiosaur would have looked like. That's like the standard model. The functionality of this bizarre body plan is pretty much anybody's guess, but it's coming up that through most recent sort of fluid dynamics modeling, and even people have built functioning models that swim and things like this. But the idea is that it's an animal that swims probably something like a turtle, and lives pretty much in a whole variety of ways. So the body plan, the standard plesiosaur body plan, actually modified many, many times through its evolution. So you had the fabulous kind of long neck type of thing, but you had the fairly early in their evolutionary history, they split into two major radiations. One being the plesiosaur-like body plan, the other one is the pliosaur-type body plan. And this is where you have something that looks like a colossal crocodile with a short tail and flippers. Massive heads, some of them the size of cars, teeth the size of bananas.
That's the Jurassic World jumping out of the water one.
Well, that's supposed to be a mosasaur. This is before mosasaurs even were thought about in an evolutionary perspective. Plesiosaurs were doing the same thing. But it's mega predators. This is monstrous, 12 meter, even, some estimates make them even bigger, but it's colossal apex predators, the size of Tyrannosaurus rex swimming around in the ocean type of thing. So it's an ecosystem, and they're occupying a range of niches doing different things. What plesiosaurs ate? Well, they ate each other. We know that. They also ate, obviously fish and this kind of stuff. There's a lot of really very interesting gut contents and this sort of bits and pieces, which suggests that the actual long neck sort of body plan is actually quite a multi-utility model, if you want. So the gut contents will range from everything from pterosaurs to fish to squid bits, to even they look like it's eating off the seafloor, like a big vacuum cleaner, sucking up mud and sieving stuff out of the water, out of the mud at the bottom of the sea. So I think basically the general body plan is actually quite variable in terms of what it can do. And I think that you could best characterize it as a multi-purpose, middle trophic level predator. I've been involved in some interesting work a couple of years ago where we looked at actually how fast plesiosaurs formed their teeth, which is critical if you want to understand how feeding works. So we kind of took some teeth and cut them up and looked at what's called von Ebner lines. And this is the increments at which a tooth grows. So when you grow your teeth in your jaw, you're laying down dentine in daily increments. And if you can cut the teeth up, you can actually see inside and count the number of lines. It's just like tree rings, and work out how long it's taking for the teeth to form. Unusually, we were looking at elasmosaurs, which I'll get to in a bit, but these are the super long-necked plesiosaurs. And they're taking, if your crocodile, your average croc takes up to about 12 months to form its teeth. These guys are taking anywhere from 2 to 3 years. Why? Why is this occurring? It's very, very slow tooth formation. Part of it is probably to do, they have this very strange tooth replacement mechanism where they have two rows of teeth. So one forms and then shifts the old one out. So it's this odd resorption thing going on. But the idea is you never find, unless it's the big hypercarnival ones, they never really have worn teeth. You might get an odd broken tooth, but they're usually quite rare. So the idea is they're actually being very gentle with their teeth, it seems. So it's more acting more like a kind of meshwork type of sieve rather than something that's kind of crushing or piercing anything. So the idea is it's again, this sort of multi-purpose feeding mechanism. And I think this is key to the why they were so successful. They were just generalists. They ate whatever they could get hold of, and they were very successful at aquatic locomotion. And they swam all over the world in every possible ecosystem, every possible seaway, from fresh waters to the pelagic depths of the, you know, the open ocean. They were there. So this is an incredibly successful body plan and model. And you have to think that the plesiosaurs were around for 143 million years. It's a mind-boggling time frame. You know, it's more than twice as long as whales have been around. So it was a very, very successful body plan and a very, very successful ecological model. And that's pretty much what they were. There's every indication that they were hot-blooded. The degree of endothermy is open to question. But what we can see, so, for example, from Australia, we have some teeth that come from a very unusual locality, which is right down on the south coast, and is the famous Dinosaur Cove type of locality. So this, if you've ever watched Walking with Dinosaurs, the denizens of the ice forest, that's southern Australia. But the rivers from this time also had plesiosaurs in them. So the idea is that we can use these plesiosaur teeth to understand the environment by looking at the isotopes that were trapped in the enamel when the animal formed its teeth. And you can also use this because fresh waters and seawaters leave slightly different isotopic signatures. We can also work out whether our plesiosaurs were migrating. So what we've been able to tell, and again, this is new results, is that basically they're living under ice year round. So the idea is that you have, they're not marine. These are totally freshwater plesiosaurs. And don't forget, they're taking 2 to 3 years to form their teeth. So we're pretty confident that this isn't just a migratory cycle. These things are living there under ice during the winters. So you have to imagine that it's an animal that can survive pretty cold temperatures and do so quite happily. This isn't a turtle that can burrow into the mud. This is an animal that has to swim around. So you have to kind of imagine something like a seal living in a river way down at the South Pole at about 80 degrees south 120 million years ago. And this is kind of what it is. So Loch Ness isn't really that much off this. the idea of something living in Loch Ness is actually pretty feasible. It's not that bizarre. But, you know, it's an animal that's not it's not like a lizard. It's not a lizard living in the water. This is something which is far more advanced, something very much, much more akin to sea lions and this sort of thing that we have today. But also, interestingly, very similar to the leatherback sea turtle. So the leatherback sea turtle is, it's a reptile, but it has, because of its size, a relatively high metabolic rate. It can swim into the North Sea. And it has all these other, you know, physiological and anatomical mechanisms to maintain a sort of high metabolism. But the idea also of the leatherback turtle is it has leathery skin. And this sort of touches on the question of what did plesiosaurs actually look like? What was their skin like? What was their body form like? And this is also more work that we're involved in at the moment. Recently, a colleague of mine, Johan Lindgren at Lund University, led a project that I was involved in looking at soft tissue preservation in ichthyosaurs. And the idea of this was trying to really understand what's preserved in these, you know, iconic ichthyosaur body outlines, the black body outlines. As it turns out, it's largely original skin. You know, you can demineralize this stuff and it wobbles in a petri dish. So it's original skin that's 170 million years old, but it's full of cellular material, organic material, and blubber residue. So you can actually get a fairly good idea of what the skin looked like. The skin of ichthyosaurs was smooth. It wasn't scaly. It looked very, very much like cetacean skin or the skin of a leatherback sea turtle. Unfortunately, unlike ichthyosaurs, there aren't too many of these Holzmarten specimens that have skin preserved. There is a plesiosaur specimen from Mexico which has some skin, and there are actually a couple of Holzmarten plesiosaurs with skin residues. And what these actually tell us is that the skin is also probably smooth, and again probably look much like leatherback sea turtle skin. But intriguingly, it's not the model. You know, if you go to in the UK, you go to Crystal Palace. And they have these fabulous models from the 19th century of these kind of plesiosaurs. It's partly right, but the really interesting bit is it's also partly wrong. So it actually turns out that plesiosaurs have tail fins. And it's very, very possible that they might have had some sort of dorsal fin structure. So the idea is your body plan actually is quite different to what you generally envisage for what these animals look like. It's something that looks a bit more like a cross between a whale and a turtle, which, as the classic analogy goes, a snake threaded through the body. It's a very, very weird-looking animal. But again, a very successful one. They were around for a very, very long time. And this is part of the sort of growing picture of what we understand of what plesiosaurs were and ecologically what they were. In the broader perspective of their evolution, the evolution of plesiosaurs is actually a bone of contention. Everybody's debating how the evolutionary tree works and all this kind of stuff. So what I've been interested in doing is finding ways to kind of resolve this, but more importantly, to understand how the evolution of plesiosaurs was driven and responded to major global changes in tectonics, sea level, and climate. Sitting down in opal mines in Australia, scratching my head, wondering how does an animal live in a freezing polar sea, or sitting in the Arctic going, well, hang on a second, how did these guys evolve with all this sort of stuff? Climate seems to be part, a very integral part of the story. It's very, very difficult to actually work out drivers of things. It's the fossil record is not that clear cut. You can't say, okay, climate made this happen. What we can get is some kind of inference of linking two things together, more or less causally through time. So the idea is trying to marry up the evolutionary record with what we can see in the environmental record of major climate change events. And as I mentioned, the beginning of the Triassic, the end of the Triassic and being beginning of the Jurassic and the middle of the Cretaceous are some of the biggies. Not just for climate, but also sea level. So sea level is at its lowest at the end of the Triassic. It goes way down and then bounces back up. Coincidentally, this is when plesiosaurs evolve. So the idea is, can we look at this kind of sea level fluctuations and model it against the phylogenies and time to put the whole thing together? And the answer is yes. So what we can see, and again, this is some of the new work that's going on now, is actually that pretty decisively the origination of plesiosaurs, at least based on our globally kind of biased fossil record, because don't forget, we only get plesiosaurs, they're not all over the place all the time in the fossil record. We only have certain places that will produce rocks and fossils of certain ages. But basically what we can see is that, yes, the early Jurassic radiation, late Triassic to early Jurassic radiation of plesiosaurs was intimately linked with sea level drop. Sea level goes down, you have sort of local areas where you have a speciation occurring, and then this is where it starts off from. Strangely enough, this is also the same point at which plesiosaurs first ecologically radiate into freshwater environments. So does the drop in sea level drive them up rivers and this type of thing, which they then occupy for the rest of their evolutionary history? That seems to be kind of linked together. Then the idea is you have a sort of pulses of globalization that come out of what is now Europe and then spread all over the world. So the idea is that, you know, you more or less have responses to tectonics. Imagine the supercontinent Pangaea starts to break up and it creates seaways. This is the superhighways of the Mesozoic, and off they go. They use these to radiate around the world and pop up everywhere from kind of, you know, Europe to the South Pole. But in time, you know, the climates are changing constantly and the tectonics is moving all the time. We can see this in the pattern of the fossil record. They start to pop up in southern South America. They start to go global. And by the Cretaceous, when we have the cold snap and the super global warming event by about 90 million years ago, again, another big pulse of globalization. And curiously, this is where the Australian fossil record and the opal fossils come into it. Because what we see there is actually the earliest members of globally distributed late Cretaceous lineages. The pole was a birthplace for some of the most successful plesiosaurs of all time. we're talking now about what's called polychaetylids. These are the sort of long-snouted, fast-swimming fish eaters that lasted up until the end of the Cretaceous. But they originated at the South Pole. So you have this kind of these polar origination events and globalization stories all wrapped up with climate and tectonics. And this is really looking at the big picture story of what, using plesiosaurs as a model to understand how marine vertebrates, marine tetrapods in this case, respond to their environment, what they do with it. And what we can see is that it's the same triggers we know of caused the evolution of whales. The Southern Ocean, you know, Antarctica, the circumantarctic current, the initiation of cold waters and bioproductivity makes feeding grounds. And then you have big animals that migrate around to make use of it. And their biology changes to accommodate this. And that's exactly what we're seeing in the fossil record. So plesiosaurs are actually telling us a story which models what we see in marine tetrapods today. They did exactly the same thing, you know, 100 million years later. But it's a very interesting story because it's much like the evolution of animals to flight, birds, bats, and pterosaurs. You have these sort of convergences, these commonalities, and you're looking at turtles, crocodiles, plesiosaurs, ichthyosaurs, mosasaurs, a whole bunch of lineages all adapting to life in the oceans, and they do the same thing over and over and over and again because it's the same environmental constraints affecting body plans, affecting evolution. And this is kind of really what the fossil record is all about. And as a paleontologist, this is the really interesting stuff. So that's what I do. That's my day at the office.
So that was a really fantastic explanation of everything that anyone would ever need to know about plesiosaurs, about Australasia, paleogeography, paleoclimatology. It is all in there. But I want to know more about Australia because when I think about marine reptiles, think about marine tetrapods, it is all based, as you said, Holzmarden Shale in Germany, Lyme Regis in the UK. But in Australia, do you think that it's an underappreciated location from where you can find all of these marine reptiles and discover more about their evolution? Should we be paying more attention to Australia?
Absolutely, particularly for marine reptiles. I mean, basically, as I mentioned, Central Australia is literally Cretaceous seafloor. You know, the explorers that went out there looking for the camels looking for the inland sea, it was there. They were just 100 million years too late. But the idea is that it's full of some absolutely spectacular material. Further north, out of the opal mines, for example, it occurs in these limestone concretions, which can be acid prepared, and you end up with bones that look so fresh the animal could have died yesterday. It's an amazing locality. But the reason why it's never been publicized to the same extent as, say, Europe or North America is simply because of density of people and time. The first marine reptile fossils were found in the 1860s, but it was largely kind of ignored. Nobody really bothered because Australia is the end of the world. What's happened over the last, say, 20 years is that more and more of the information is getting out there. And the most recent work is actually the most interesting because now it's lifting the scope with new technologies and looking at things in a different way on a global perspective, which is giving us these climate stories, giving us this whole new way of looking at ancient marine ecosystems and looking at ancient marine ecosystems for a very unique environmental setting. Australia is a unique environmental setting today. It's been a unique environmental setting for almost its entire geological history because of its geological placement way down at the South Pole or in the Southern Hemisphere. It's the sort of last stop in the sort of bit of land that you get. So the idea that this geographic isolation, which has been around for a very long time, has shaped some very unusual creatures. But like I said, it's not just been somewhere where things go to die. It's actually the cradle of radiations that go on to dominate the oceans of the world. It's very, very important, but it's simply a matter of accumulating data. You can count the number of paleontologists in Australia on two hands. There's not that many there. So it's just the density of people and the amount of work being done. Having said that, you know, as time goes on, I'm sure there'll be more and more people with growing interests in places like Australia. Africa is another great place to go for some very interesting things, and the Arctic and Antarctica, obviously, you know, the last untouched bits of land. But there's, you know, the beauty of Australia, you can go to the remote end of the world in a first world country with all the the mod cons of everything you want. So it's a very comfortable place to do fieldwork. But the you know, the discoveries are incredible, and it's really, to excuse the pun, just the tip of the iceberg on what is to be found there. There's some amazing stuff, and it's a very, very big, empty place with a lot of rock and a lot of fossils.
So with so few academic paleontologists actually working there and looking and exploring for the fossils, what balance is there between academia and then commercial production of opal? And how do those two interact? And is it an issue?
It's the opal is entirely commercial. But I think the saving grace is the way the opal is mined, is not by big companies. It's mined by, you know, 100 meter square personal plots. This is people that mine for a lifestyle. So, you know, you're dealing with individuals and individual claims, and everybody's different. So it's the way people mine. A lot of it's, you know, if it's done by an individual, it's done on a small scale, that their likelihood of seeing fossils in the ground as they're mining increases. You know, some people use tunneling machines and large excavation equipment, which certainly can destroy stuff. And some use explosives and things like this. But the idea is there's still an increased chance of things being found, unlike massive open cut mines where you know, it's a very different story. So I think this is part of the key part. But like I said, you won't get opal fossils without the miners. They're the most important people to find the stuff. What's the a very nice thing that's going on now is also there's a lot of regional museum initiatives popping up, and I've been involved in quite a few of these. And the idea is that actually creating a sort of tourism research center, and these places are government accredited. They're repositories for public material. So this material that's deposited there is public property, which means it's research property, which means people, you know, it can be worked on. So it's very pleasing to see the local community benefiting directly and being part of the science and the research and gaining something out of it and feeling ownership of it, because this is ultimately the kind of ethos that's going to protect the resources for the future. And that's a very big push in Australia. And it's to do with the geography and kind of the way the population is distributed and this sort of thing, which makes these sort of things possible. But in terms of the opal fossils, it's the way of the way to make it work, in my opinion, because you have the community values it, they see an economic value in it, they'll protect it, which means it's protected as a knowledge resource as well. And if we can contribute to that as scientists, then we've done our job. If we can market it for them to promote the museum as a tourism attraction, to promote the resources for people to go and see it, we've done our job. So that's a way for us to give back and make sure things, you know, the fossils themselves are looked after for the future.
So if you're an opal miner, you find a opalized plesiosaur. I mean, we're talking many meters, perhaps, of opal. Wouldn't you just be like, wow, this is payday, crush it all up, sell it off? What would encourage them to keep it for science as opposed to see it for just its material value?
The first step is for them to understand what it is. So, you know, now I'm very pleased to say, you know, the opal miners are quite aware of what they're digging up. They know what's, you know, they're finding ancient marine animals from a freezing polar sea. They all know about it because there's a museum in the center of town that has a big display about it. And their kids go to the museum and see all this sort of stuff. The tourists come into the museum and see all this sort of stuff. So the museums are the kind of focal point for the whole resource protection and the epicenter of what's going on. The idea, though, is they have to make a living. That's completely understandable. So what generally occurs is the fossils are appraised. So there are actually fossil valuers in Australia, and they'll contact museums, the big state museums, for this kind of thing, and they'll tell them whether the significance of it and whether it's available for commercial trade or it's something that needs to be protected. There's also a cultural heritage appropriation program. So the idea is they can get a tax rebates for basically donating material. Or what usually happens is they attract a third-party buyer, which will buy the fossil and then donate it to a museum for the tax break. And that's the incentive to protect this stuff and get it into the state museums for research, preparation. And then the nice part is actually sending some of the material back for display in places like Coober Pedy and Lytton Ridge and these other open mining towns. And that's very not very pleasing to say that's what's going on to a large extent now. So a lot of these very important fossils are finding their way back to these museums and are protected for the future because the local community can go and see their own finds. They can go and have a look and go, wow, I found that. And that gives them a sense of ownership and the circle's complete. The thing works. And it's protected for the future. It's protected for science.
And you've been down an opal mine. What was it like?
It depends where you are. So there's not just one opal field. There's many. There's lots and lots and lots of them. They all are, like I said, they're all mined by individuals, and the individuals mine in different ways. Some people open cut their mine. So they'll have a big, excavator. They'll come in and dig a big hole and process all the stuff. And at Coober Pedy, the opals fluoresces. So you can run it under a UV light and it lights up like a, ping, you can see your opal. And that's they're picking in a dark room. And then they'll sort through that and then see, you'll find the fossils and bits and pieces. Others will mine underground. And they'll either mine using machinery of some sort or explosives and this kind of thing. And again, take the opal dirt out and process it and look for the opal. In places like Lightning Ridge, it's a little bit different. It's a lot of underground mining. So imagine if you go to work there, it's basically this sort of bush landscape, which is quite dry, with these piles of white clay dirt all over the place, which is the mine tailings. And then you have to climb down these rickety ladders down a meter diameter cut hole drill shaft, down about 20 meters to the opal layer. And off you go. And then some of these underground mines are cut like ballrooms underground, all these pillars to hold the roof up. And you're kind of wandering around underground looking at the walls, and the opal's just in the wall. It's bones and shells and bits and pieces, and it's all this stuff that's just the opal replacing the fossil material. Lightning Ridge is a slightly different one. If anybody's heard of Lightning Ridge, it's another opal mine, opal mining area, which is it's not marine. So this is actually the remains of probably an estuary and rivers that flowed into an inland sea. So you have a bigger component of things like dinosaurs. But there's also distant ancestors of the modern platypus and all sorts of bizarre creatures that were swimming around in the waters there. But again, it's all opalized. This is all opalized material. So the idea with this is again, this is underground mining. There's fewer of the big open cuts that you get at Coober Pedy, but the fossils are coming out all the time. And the opal dirt there is processed like the big cement mixer trucks. So they've taken the cement mixer off the truck and they just roll the opal dirt around to break it up. And then they run the tailings out and you sort through it looking for opal. But it's bones and shells and bits of wood and all sorts of things turn up. So it's a whole ecosystems sort of caught in the spotlight of these fabulous opal fossils. It's quite amazing.
So to conclude, which questions do we still have to answer? We're talking large-scale things, we're talking small-scale things. What is left to know about marine tetrapods in Australasia?
Everything. It goes from one end to the other. In terms of my own work, I'm very interested in both in big and small scale. Fundamentally, what were these animals? How did they live? What did they look like? How can we reconstruct the biology of something that's been dead for 100 million years? this is one of the key projects I'm involved in now, looking at trying to, in particular, understand what we can get out of the soft tissue and molecular paleontological record. What can we see in terms of trying to extract biomolecules, pigments, this kind of thing? What color were plesiosaurs, if anybody can say that? This is an ongoing project right now, and it's yielding some very interesting results, which I've touched on. But the idea is, this is down at the, if you want to talk about scales, this is the molecular level, really, really small scale stuff. The material is coming actually from Europe by and large, but the story is a global one, which impacts on plesiosaurs from everywhere. The other side of the coin is, you know, the physiological, the biology of the animal. How did its system work? Again, this is where the Australian record comes to the fore. We have an animal living, or animals living, in an extreme environment with very peculiar climatic and geographic constraints. We can use this to work backwards to understand how an animal would adapt to live in that, and then extrapolate to the whole group. So the idea of using things like isotopes to understand physiology and their environment and behavioral adaptations, that's very important. Then taking it to the other end of the spectrum is looking at global pictures. Again, what can plesiosaurs as a model lineage? And again, don't forget, this is one of, if not the most successful group of marine adapted tetrapods ever to have evolved on the face of the planet. 143 million years of continuous evolution is just mind-boggling, but they did it. It happened. So how can we look at this incredibly long geological history and evolutionary history and use that to model how a continuous lineage will adapt to major environmental, tectonic, and climatic change? They're a perfect model organism, and we can use that to understand everything of how a group will adapt to life in water, to how literally marine vertebrates, how they radiate, how they get around, what drives their evolution on a global scale. Why do they go where they go? How do they go where they go? This has obvious and very real implications for what we understand today. So in answer to the question, it's going from the micro to the macro and everything in between, because I'm interested in interesting problems. And this is, you know, the plesiosaurs are one of the great groups from the fossil record that has so much information to tell and great stories to tell. And it has, you know, a very real impact on what we understand about marine environments and marine animals today. So that's why they're so interesting.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Ben. It's been absolutely fascinating.
It's a pleasure.
Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall and Liz Martin-Silverstone, with contributions from Tom Fletcher, Vish Venkat, and Elsa Pancharoli. Music was composed by Patrick Kendall-Smith. Paleocast was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, but the show now relies on funding from you, the listeners. So, if you've liked this episode, please consider donating, and thanks to everyone that's helped out so far. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programs, and follow us across social media platforms to get all the latest news. Finally, if you enjoy our podcast, then please explore all of our video content on YouTube and follow our other projects, the Virtual Natural History Museum and the Paleocast Gaming Network.